This episode of The Stack was first broadcast on the 5th of January 2013.
An editor with a few views on where print media might end up in 2013, a table full of our top titles, and a vantage point from the top of Europe. Edition 19 of The Stack is in Semmeritz. Also coming up on today's program, we'll reminisce with a colleague about the last days of Newsweek.
What really made them stand out from the crowd was their frontline reporting and the amount of investment that they put into all these amazing, intrepid writers who would be there on the ground reporting back. And I think that's maybe where they lost it.
And we'll hear what sells best in the kiosks of the Engadine.
A lot of German, Frankfurter Allgemeine, Süddeutsche, Welt, French newspaper, Le Monde, Figaro, and also Arabian.
All that and a fair bit more over the next 60 minutes right here on Monocle 24. Hello and a very happy new year from Semmeritz and this special 18th edition of The Stack. I'm Tyler Brulé. As we have the good fortune to be perched on the rooftop of Europe for today's show, we thought we'd seize the wide open vistas to look across the coming months and gauge where the print side of media might be heading. Earlier this week, the Tribune Company emerged from bankruptcy and all eyes were on Rupert Murdoch to see what papers he might snatch up from the fire sale. No surprise that the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune are among his top picks. At the same time, the last edition of Newsweek came off newsstands with a rather ironic cover that nodded to both its demise and a possible future. We start today with a Monocle editor who did a stint at Newsweek and our editor, Andrew Tuck, who's done more than his share of time on dailies and weeklies. And joining me around this very nice Swiss oak table is our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our senior editor, Sophie Grove. We spent a lot of time over really the past months and weeks, almost a week hasn't gone by that we haven't touched on really the demise of Newsweek. I can see you've got it open there, but for people who haven't seen the cover yet, I think it's worth describing this aerial shot, this black and white image, Newsweek in red, and then they've got this hashtag last print issue, and that's it. And a rather sort of, quite austere cover, and also not a very thick one either. You would have thought maybe they would have blown it out slightly for their swan song, but that hasn't quite happened. Just to start, Sophie, just take us back a little bit. Your time at Newsweek, as a young journalist, was it really sort of the place that you wanted to start?
It was. It was an amazing start for me. I mean, I was really sort of schooled there as a reporter, and I worked under some incredible journalists who, I really learnt the trade from. And I think that's what Newsweek did so well. They had this kind of apprenticeship. Yeah, you started as a researcher and then you really learnt from your colleagues. And I worked with Stryker Maguire and Rod Nordland in the London Bureau for a couple of years, both of whom, just great teachers, really.
Mm. And Andrew, I wanted to bring you into it, and I can see you're already flipping through Dogs magazine, which I should have actually put at the bottom of the pile. You're already distracted.
I'm going to come to that in a minute.
I know you're going to come to Dogs in a minute, but just your view when you look at this last issue of Newsweek, and of course I want to spend a bit of time throughout today's program looking where we might end up. Do you think this is really it for Newsweeklies, or is Newsweek an example of a title that just slightly misjudged the market, maybe got a little bit comfortable, and maybe was never quite sure whether it wanted to be an American magazine and should have become truly a global title?
I think that's certainly true. I think when you look at this issue, it really does feel like the end of something. And they seem to have kind of cornered themselves, really, over the last few years. They've kind of tried to reinterpret what they're doing. They're very caught up in this American version of what's happening to the news. So they're keen to kind of do things that almost like the web in print. They just seem to get a little bit lost. I don't think it's the end of the weekly, but I think for the US market it may be. But I think in Europe you still see countries, you know, such as Germany, there's still a strong foundation for the News Weekly, and I don't think that's going to go away.
Yeah, I don't want to come back to it. We've got the current edition of Der Spiegel sitting here with the cover Oman, Das starke Geschlecht durch seine neue Rolle, and it's Michelangelo's David with his hands in his head. We'll come back to that in a second. But Sophie, do you think that was also, you know, part of the issue, not quite knowing perhaps what the editorial mandate or even who the reader for Newsweek was anymore? So yes, you've got this great team of journalists, you've got this extraordinary global access, and then a U.S. edition, and then these international editions as well, which maybe sometimes felt a little bit anemic.
It's really interesting. I joined at a time when the new editor, Fareed Zakira, was sort of repositioning the magazine and taking it away from reporting, and this kind of unique, very vintage style of group reporting to a more of a kind of editorial comment. Mm. And in a way, that just didn't
work. Because that was less expensive?
Exactly. Lots of academics were writing, and he himself was this, you know, this absolutely incredible, incisive and brilliant commentator. But in a sense, that didn't work for Newsweek, because they're, you know, what really made them, you know, stand out from the crowd was their front-line reporting and the amount of investment that they put into all these amazing, intrepid writers who would be there on the ground reporting back. And I think that's maybe where they lost it.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, do you think also maybe the story of Newsweek would have been slightly different had it not been a U.S. title? Had it been an English-language title that was maybe sitting in London, knowing that that The Economist was really its sparring partner on its doorstep? And you know, we always come back to this slightly defeatist attitude that a lot of U.S. companies have, that they just, you know, they throw up their hands to digital and they're not really interested in paper.
I think that's only true. And let's remember that we've seen the kind of the reemergence of Bloomberg Businessweek as a really kind of strong weekly title out of the U.S., a title that we admire and that has done clever things. It's not that they've spent a huge amount of money on the actual print stock, but they've been inventive with what they do on page. And I think the fact is that when you look at something like Newsweek, it just looks dead on the page. It battled between whether it was meant to be commenting or whether it was meant to be reporting. And, you know, in comparison to some of the other things we see on the newsstand, it's terrible. And it's a shame when you read, you know, Tina Brown has done a piece at the front called A New Chapter, which talks about what's happening to the magazine. And you can't help feel it's like one of those notes almost written to the staff when you realise you're reading between the lines that just things just aren't good. Because the headline of a piece is, sometimes change isn't just good, it's necessary. And it's the whole piece is about the kind of terrible shifts that have been going on. You don't read it and think, oh my God, they're so excited about this new chapter. You think they've been pushed into it and they feel, you know, slightly, you know, oh my God, we all need to be on cue with this. But you don't feel that they really are.
It's just such a shame in a way that, you know, Tina took over. She was doing an interesting job, controversial job, of relaunching the magazine. And it feels like, you know, it was sold for a dollar. She says this in this intro. And then it just didn't work out. And there's a feeling of, like, we've given up. Mm. And they say, oh, we're going to relaunch, you know, in the new year with an iPad format, but no other details are given.
Right.
You know, she's losing. And then she's talking about the challenges that, you know, of inheriting such a bloated organisation. And from my perspective, it was interesting, you know, joining the London Bureau. I kind of joined as people started leaving around me. I sort of took it personally. But, you know, there were 23 bureaus at one time for Newsweek. And these aren't small bureaus. They're sort of, you know, well-staffed assistants. You know, at one point the London Bureau, you know, the Bureau Chief had his own chauffeur and, you know, house in Mayfair. It was more like a sort of embassy situation.
Right.
And then to see it go from that to what we see now, when it's more or less going to be an app, is very sad.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, that's what's interesting as well, that, you know, isn't it always slightly the party line that everyone inherits something, oh, and it's bloated and therefore we have to make it fit and able? But, well, what's wrong with 23 bureaus if your job is to cover, you know, the patch which we happen to call the world? Well, then you need that many bureaus.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the number of bureaus, but I think obviously Sophie's kind of hinting there that there was at times a kind of a throwback to the kind of the 60s, a kind of generation where there was no competition to print media, and then suddenly you could have a Rolls Royce in the drive and a driver and those things. Obviously, when we set up our bureau, we don't quite offer that to our staff. But you know, I agree with you. The reason these organisations were successful was because they had people on the ground. Interesting, again, in Tina's opening salvo in this final issue, she says, that she talks about one reporter being a one-man bureau for the Arab world. Well, that's, if they've got to that point and that's meant to be something to celebrate, that isn't great.
She's talking about Christopher Dickey, who is an amazing journalist, and he also writes from Paris as well. I mean, you cannot believe how much he covered during the Arab Spring. I'd be reading it just agog, really, because he was so hardworking. And I mean, they were very lucky to inherit those really amazing stalwarts from the old Newsweek. So many of them left. Mm. And then they, you know, hired their own new staff and the news beast model. But it just doesn't have the kudos. It doesn't have the people's trust. As we've seen, you know, you look at Businessweek, we read that because we know that it's informed and we know that it's got this incredible engine behind it of knowledge and expertise, and that's why we buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Andrew, do you think there's much excitement? I'm not sure what day they're going back into the office, or maybe they already came back to the office at Newsweek, at Daily Beast, Inc. But do you think it's that feeling of charging ahead into 2013, or it's a bit of treading water?
Well, what's interesting is when you come out of print, you're suddenly in a slightly different competition. So I think, unfortunately, they'll be up against more kind of things like the Huffington Post. They'll be kind of competing more with even more kind of gossipy things like the Gawker. You know, I don't think that people will be going to them in the way that they used to. They'll become a very different brand. Now, in the US, you are seeing, you know, they are further ahead in this kind of, you know, this rush to digital. But I still think that you lose some credibility when you take away the paper. And we've seen it, you know, over the last year. We've talked about various people who do have websites and who found the need to add paper, actually, and have found that kind of beefs up their brand.
I love weekly news magazines because you can just pop them in your pocket and then, you know, they're super light.
Those are big pockets. If you happen to be wearing a big fur coat and Sam Ritz,
yeah,
like
well,
you are at the moment, then
you can get
a couple of Newsweeks.
You know, you can really, I mean, in the same way that you can sort of dig into a monthly, you can sort of really just, I don't know, you can kind of, you know, work through them. I think there's still a really good space for a weekly news magazine. And the way that they used to cover the news, it was so agile, actually. It's kind of a combination of a daily and that analysis. I mean, you've worked on weeklies, and it's so interesting. On Friday night, you know, that was the night when Newsweek pulled together. And in this issue, they're talking about, you know, those bonding moments when they're working late, all the different sort of comings and goings and politics inside Newsweek, even. It was like a little mini sovereign state at one point.
But don't you think that I wonder whether it's because, you know, what they were selling was, you know, a US perspective on the world. So the fact is that actually the Asian market has become much more sophisticated now. The other markets where they were kind of doing versions of the magazine just kind of don't want to buy it in the same way. That American perspective doesn't sell quite so easily. Whereas if you're selling something like, you know, Bloomberg Businessweek or The Economist, what you're kind of selling is something that's very globalized. It's a take on the world according to, you know, finance or according to entrepreneurship. But here they were trying to sell something that just didn't really feel very comfortable outside the US borders anymore. And even within it, you know, they just didn't quite have that tone of voice of confidence, I don't think.
And we've touched on this before. I am almost surprised that the Qataris didn't pick it up, that actually someone who wanted to, you really operate with a big Middle East media base, and we've seen it happening in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Doha. That sounds like, well, you know, this is a snip. I'm sure that, you know, the likes of Mr. Diller and everybody else invested in Newsweek would only be, you know, too happy if they came along and said, yeah, you know, and it would be, you know, arguably a more interesting story to say, look at, you know, they actually decided to go and, you know, put their news hub at the end of the runway in Dubai.
Yeah, and again, you know, another thing we talked about recently was about, you know, how New York as a city kind of generates so many good weekly magazines as well. It's not that the US can't do it. It really just does feel that this one little sector has kind of given up the ghost.
Yeah, I want to just draw, just as we're talking about, Sophie, your love of news weeklies. And of course, you know, Panorama's had a redesign earlier in the year. They went for this quite a cozy serif font. But I just want to draw your attention to, you know, someone who's maybe taken the inspiration of Business Week. And you need to, you know, and one of the exciting things about Business Week, which we've touched on from time to time, are just the amazing infographics. As you said, this enormous research machine that's behind it in the form of Bloomberg. But this is how not to use infographics. Now, this is the issue, which is the 26th of December issue of Panorama. They've got a McDonald's cover. And then their infographic is what you can do with French fries. So they've used, you know, French fries of sort of varying lengths to go and illustrate a growth story for McDonald's in the Italian market. I don't think anyone at Business Week should be terribly worried, though.
That's a very big chip at the end, though. Yeah.
And there's a woman balancing on one leg on one of the chips, and another man lounging on one.
It's quite something, isn't it? But I wanted to go back to Der Spiegel. Andrew, do you think, when you touch on that notion of the United States and obviously a changed position in the world, for Newsweekly to work, like, and you know, you were celebrating New York Magazine a couple of weeks ago when we were just doing our year-end roundup. I mean, does New York Magazine work also because it's got the confines of those bureaus and at its really at the max of the tri-state area? And yes, we can still love it in London, but it's not essential reading. But do we still love the title partly because of the confines of geography?
Well, I think, yeah, the confines of geography, but that's still only having enough people to cover all the bases. And that's what you were talking about earlier. If these other news magazines had enough people in all the bases in all the countries that they need to report from, then it wouldn't be a problem. The good thing about New York Magazine, it does have the city covered. But it is funny that, you know, there is a city magazine that feels more international, feels that it's telling you more about the US and the world when you pick it up in London than supposedly a magazine that's covering the whole of the world. Mm. And if it's got to that point, there's something that really is out of kilter.
But I think that's a really good point, because the demographic in New York is so much more international, whereas Newsweek was trying to appeal to, you know, 4 million readers all around America. And that's probably where it fell down, because they didn't necessarily want to have the sophisticated insights that maybe a New Yorker might want.
Just before we go to break, we often talk about Der Spiegel as an interesting model, one which has become very comfortable with itself as a newsweekly. One would argue now the most powerful newsweekly in Europe, though maybe The Economist might say otherwise. But because they've really struck a relationship between what the magazine does with its subscription website, what it does with, let's say, its daily website for everybody else, and then the print edition. But I'm wondering if also part of its success, again, is that it also lives within the borders of the Federal German Republic. And it can still take a totally global view, but it always knows it's got the confidence of, well, what will the Berlin line be, or how does this play to the DAX in Frankfurt or wherever it may be?
I think undoubtedly it has a clear view of how it looks out from Germany to see the world, which is you know, fascinating, and comes at a time when we all recognise that Germany is actually more powerful in Europe than it's ever been. But I also think that they do obviously benefit from the fact that Germany as a nation has kind of adopted this kind of slow media model, where we see, you know, CD sales still holding up better than elsewhere in Europe. Book sales still incredibly strong. That people in Germany, they take pride in being a little bit more intellectual. They take pride in reading things, and you can stick 5,000 words in front of them on a Sunday and they'll sit down and read it.
And in terms of international audiences, people really want to know the German perspective on the world as they get more and more powerful. In a way, we read Der Spiegel just to see their take on things, and it's really useful for that.
Mm. And I think also, Andrew, your point is also the German newsstand reflects that. Okay, we're in a predominantly German-speaking part of Switzerland. We'll talk about the kiosks here in a little while in this program as well. But then there is just that sense of just international hunger, which, you know, as we know, is one of the great crimes of the newsstand, not just in the UK, but I think also if we look at to the other side of the Atlantic as well.
Yeah, and what's been great for us, you know, as a brand Monocle, you know, that we had a very easy entry into the German market in a sense, because people were very receptive to a big fat news title. They weren't concerned about what is this. They understood it inherently from the word go, and that's why we've always done incredibly well in Germany. And, you know, and we sell alongside, you know, magazines like Brand Eins. Again, not a huge amount of photography in there. In fact, very limited photography. It's about the reading experience. Mm. And it just is fascinating that the Germans still do have a kind of ability to kind of switch off, put their phones down, and read, read, and read.
You are listening to The Stack. We are in St. Moritz. Today we're having a special look-ahead program. We're back after this short break.
Home to almost every alpine cliche you can imagine, Switzerland's remote Lower Engadine has its own brand of old-fashioned charm. Monocle's film crew put on their snow boots to capture a world lost in time.
In earlier times, there was a clear hierarchy in the village. First of all came the priest, then the teacher, then the blacksmith. The one who controlled the fire, actually the master of the fire, that was then, in the belief of the people, a bit a higher person.
Mountain Magic on monocle.com.
And you're back with this special look-ahead edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, Sophie Grove, and Andrew Tuck. Now, I'm going to give you a bit of a New Year's option. Do we want to look ahead across 2013? Andrew, as I said earlier in the program, you couldn't wait to jump into Dogs magazines. Now, the table's already a mess of titles, but I did try to really sort of pull together, you know, a variety of things which you know, speak to a variety of areas. And I think, you know, one is from time to time over the course of the year, we have spoken about that really interesting section of the newsstand in Japan, which is about the whole LOHAS movement, you know, lifestyles of health and sustainability, and people setting up their own goat farms and, you know, going and raising their own bees, and how do they then come up with an incredible lip balm brand out of all of that, you know, wax that they're producing, etc. And, you know, and then we did, you know, slowly move our attention to say that, well, oddly, that was happening in Japan, but it's also happening in Germany as well. And so some of the titles that I've grabbed, we've got the likes of Landlust, which has some lovely swans on the cover for you, Sophie. And then, Andrew, I got you Schweizer Landliebe. I can see you in this. It's a very, it's a nice cozy, it's a Hüttenzauber. It's a very nice little alpine hut. I could see you gathered around that very big, chunky oak table on those nice benches. There's actually, well, maybe it looks like Sophie's visiting, because there's a big fur coat also hanging up from the rafters as well. Two points about this, though. I'm wondering, do you think it's somewhat curious? I don't know if it has anything to do with people who lost the war or something, but why are we seeing this surge in these types of magazines, which are about going back to the earth? There is a life, you know, of course there's a lifestyle element to them, but it's not in a way that is perfectly formed like Vogue Living Australia would have been, or like Real Simple, or like Martha Stewart. They're much grittier. I mean, they almost are a bit of a call to action. Say, yeah, great, go get yourself a hut, get yourself two goats, and maybe rethink your lifestyle. And I'm just wondering, why do you think we're at a point that this type of publishing is taking hold, Andrew?
Well, I think undoubtedly, you know, a rocky economy for 5 years since 2008, and lots of people leaving high-powered jobs and being shaken out of the service industries, and beginning to wonder, actually, well, how do you sustain yourself when you can't go and work in a bank? And they're beginning to think, well, actually, maybe I do need to know how to grow a few vegetables, and it's not a bad thing to be able to kind of stay at home and cook dinner myself. And actually, I don't need to have the latest of everything. I need to have things that are going to last. And I think that's reflected in different ways to all sorts of magazines. So even actually the more glossy, polished magazines are trying to pick up on that trend. But I think that when people open these magazines, I have in front of me Country, Lust auf ländliche Lebensart, another German magazine looking at the kind of country lifestyle. But I think they're all trying to kind of tap into something that's saying, do you know what, you're okay, you don't have to worry about only your job. You know, it's good to kind of roll your sleeves up, get the pickaxe out, you know, get the spatula out, start making things yourself.
It's interesting that, you know, just from a year's reporting for Monocle, just going around and looking at that kind of recalibration of people's priorities, you know, everywhere we go, really, especially places that have been really hit by the crash, you find these people that have done that, you know, gone off and just said, actually, I don't want to be a salary man anymore. I'm doing this. I'm concentrating on doing one good thing well. And you can see that in this magazine. Here's Landlust. There's a 10-page story on compost, good rot. And then one of the main pictures is a rotting, well, yes, a rotting heap of tomatoes and tea bags.
Apple peels and all sorts.
And I think in Germany at the moment, if you're a chicken, you're kind of really in risk of, you know, every day being shot to be on the cover of one magazine or another. All of these magazines have, like, chickens as some kind of denoter of kind of living the simple life. But again, I think it's also interesting when you speak to, you've got another one, Tierwelt.
Yeah, Tierwelt. This is Die Schweizer Zeitschrift für Tier und Nature. So, the Swiss magazine for animals and nature. And there you go. I mean, you have a lovely young lady with a plaid top, and she's got a big cock in her hands.
And can I ask, is that practical henning and
geese? No, it says here, well, this is a big report on, it's the National Geflügelausstellung, so it's the big bird exhibition. I think we should crack the spine, yes, on Tierwelt and see what that exhibition looks like.
But again, I think, you know, what's interesting again is will this sustain itself? I kind of think it will, actually, because when you look in the world of design, if you open design magazines at the moment, there's been certainly a move away from kind of stark metal and steel interiors to wood and softer things that feel a little bit more sustainable and homemade.
Now, I know I'm not a huge fan of necessarily having readers send in, you know, photos, and I'm never a huge fan of comment. As most probably listeners know, if you want to comment, then write us a nice letter directly. You don't have to post something down page or elsewhere. However, we're looking at Tierwelt, and I do have a lot of time for the reader's photos spread. I mean, it's quite something. Everything from, a snowman with a small, is it a shih tzu or something in front of the snowman? So the snowman's, he's got a scarf on and he's got a baseball cap. And then you've got also a dog with a Santa's hat in front.
And another dog taking another dog for a walk, who in turn is taking a teddy bear along with him to the trip. So
yeah,
that's quite nice.
The teddy bear in his mouth.
There's a little hamster, Felix, the liebling of the family.
That hamster looks like it may have died in its sleep in the night and has been stood up. It looks a bit too stiff.
Taxidermy.
I know there might be some pipe cleaners involved somewhere. And when you, oh goodness, actually there's more. There's
two fat ginger pigs.
A bunny with flopsy ears. What's your favourite one, Sophie?
Well, I think Susan Hebel's picture, don't you think, Sophie? She sent in a very nice picture of, is that looks like a turkey come pom-pom come chicken cross.
It looks a bit sort of unhappy, prickly, almost. It's going to start pecking someone.
No, but this type of publishing, Andrew, Sophie, both of you, oh my goodness, I might have to get a, there's a comeback story. Dieses comeback ist gelungen, and it's obviously clearly a speckled hen. Seems like it must have gone out of fashion at some point, but it's back. They want readers to know that.
We'll see them walking around the streets of St. Moritz, no doubt, very soon.
Yeah, but probably on someone's head. That's or turned into gloves of some sort. Does this type of publishing, though, where you have this cozy, intimate, very, very niche type of title, does this continue to endure in both of your minds? I mean, is it better seeing Flopsy the bunny and the two dogs walking each other with a teddy bear in their mouth? Is it better to look at them on matte paper like this? Or can this also migrate into a world of, endless sort of, websites as well?
Well, with Tierwelt, it's published in the way that The Week magazine is in the US and the UK. It's on a kind of newsprint stock. And I'm not sure it's a very beautiful thing, but it's only 5 francs, so it's not very expensive. But it's not a very beautiful thing. But so I'm not sure how long that will kind of maintain itself. But we also see that, I was looking at this dogs magazine. This has been around for ages. This is Germany's dog magazine. It says it's Europe's actually biggest Hund magazine. And that's not just because it has a giant dog on the cover. I think there's a kind of interest in animals and on the countryside that will be sustainable. But I don't think that means that people will only buy these magazines. I think that people still want to have something a bit more polished, and magazines do also work as escapism, and travel titles and other fashion titles still will be needed alongside these.
Sorry, go ahead, Sophie.
I was just going to say, it is interesting that they are so escapist. I mean, even though they're niche interests, you can see people sort of just, salarymen opening them and sort of drifting off into some sort of dream of their retirement. It does have that element of sort of like, one day.
But then I think we have to jump across the Atlantic to a magazine which is The New Pioneer, The Complete Guide to Self-Reliant Living. And it takes a very different turn, because I think that, you know, when we look at all of the Japanese magazines, they're very tactile. I mean, many of them are works of art, but they do feel about that they're this sort of call to action. I'm thinking about, you know, Sumu magazine, which is, you know, one of the titles which I said is really sort of my magazine of the year. But this, Grow Your Dream Farm, Off the Grid, Organic Ranching, Gardening, Wild Game. Then you've got a cover line, Go Back to the Land, Easy Plan for Buying Rural, Harness Solar on a Budget, Pickle and Ferment Year-Round Veggies and Fruit. I do feel, though, that at any moment it could sort of veer into survivalist territory, though. When you look at it, I don't know.
No, I was just going to say the same thing. It's a funny demographic that you're appealing to, especially in the U.S. market, where this kind of escaping from, you know, city life can become something a little bit more of a kind of political statement in a kind of scarier way, I think.
There are several guns in here. I mean, I was just looking at this article about how to shoot a hog, and it's really, you know, it couldn't be more graphic. And there are pictures of the guns, the different ones you can have, and you just see that it's got that pioneer. I mean, it is called the New Pioneer, but it's got that pioneer spirit, that kind of really feeling of sort of that Americana. And in a way, that's a completely different approach to what we're seeing, sort of the kinfolk model, where it's much more aesthetic, it's much more sort of fashionable, and it's much more niche.
Yeah.
And I think also the European magazines that we're looking at in this market, there are no guns. There may be a kind of a good few recipes for your meaty friends, but they're certainly not about the slaying of them.
No, I mean, actually one of the lead story when you open up, it's a piece called Coyote Trails Wilderness School, Pioneer Spotlight, where primitive living reigns supreme and all who graduate track down the cure for nature deficit disorder. But I look at the assembled class, and I think sort of bad things could happen.
That looks like a picture from the 1950s or something as well, doesn't it? It looks, yeah, it doesn't look, I'm not going to be signing up for lessons any day soon.
Amazing.
I like my countryside when you can, you don't have to go too far to get a nice cup of coffee.
Yeah, and you don't need to go venture out into the forest for a walk and then, you know, wear a helmet and a bulletproof jacket.
Did you see that medical crisis planning?
I mean,
this is survivalism, really.
Yeah.
And you're seeing more and more of this. I mean, one of the favourite pieces of Business Week a couple of weeks ago was this piece on, you know, a community that was completely self-reliant, and it was fascinating.
However, several days ago, we did. We had a gentleman on from the Südostschweiz newspaper when we did our program, The Briefing, from up here in St. Moritz, and we were talking about the lone bear, which has ventured across the border from Italy into the Engadine, and really sort of the role that this bear has sort of played in the upheaval. But I think this is a section of the magazine. Maybe we want to add this to our magazine. Backcountry. It's in the backcountry section. It's called Self-Defense. Survive a cougar attack.
And that is a very scary cougar, I have to admit. But don't worry, because on the next page is a man with a gigantic gun who will blast him out the tree.
This is useful, though. Make yourself appear as big as possible. Make as much noise as you can.
Yell
as loud as your tonsils will allow you to.
Oh, wait. Growl. Show your teeth. Look the animal directly in the eye. You're safe. You're done.
I've tried that in the office a few times as well. It's never worked.
Just limited success. I wanted to just also draw your attention to something else, which I think is just an interesting, you know, while we're sort of perusing the newsstand in this part of Europe. And from time to time, we've talked, we talk about spin-offs, etc. And I've put the cover of Neon in front of you, which is a spin-off of Stern, you know, magazine, which runs with a monthly frequency. And again, you know, a peculiar title, which seems sort of oddly politicized and is targeting this, you know, someone might sort of say is it sort of a generation, you know, Y audience, and really sort of pulling together everything. I think the cover story is, you know, is your family normal? And I, you know, really trying to come to grips with what sort of the new normal of a family is. And then there's a, you know, a rather snowy cover, two girls in Nordic jumpers, you know, hugging each other. One would like to think that maybe they're in a nice park in Berlin or somewhere in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. But Andrew, do you think that this type of magazine could work in a market like the UK or the US? Because they've got this sort of mix of reportage. The fashion is, I would say, a little bit, not quite sort of, not how to, but it, you know, a lot of it is high street, but it's, you know, it's high street in a way without sort of looking cheap, and yet just like the new Pioneer magazine, where you sort of feel you could go into survivalist mode, I sometimes sort of look at this and you feel that you could soon have people with cafes on their head and hurling bricks at German police vehicles.
It's aimed at a very interesting market. I think he's trying to celebrate kind of diversity in some way, and it's certainly aimed at a kind of a. It feels quite male. I'm not sure that many of these articles wouldn't feel too out of place actually in a men's magazine. So I don't know whether in other markets people would feel that this was.
Just both hit the same story.
Yes.
I mean, this is apps.
I can hardly believe it. Another farming story, Schweingehabt, about
pigs. I have piggies.
Yeah. And this is their author there standing with a giant pig in his arms. Yes. So again, it's a similar thing about going back to nature, why he loves his pigs, I think.
He certainly. Maybe.
Actually, he doesn't. Oh, God.
This is very German, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they've set you up for three spreads with, you know, as you said, the opening spread is the gentleman with the piggy in his arms. Then he's out actually tanning with the pigs in one shot. He's out in the pig pen. Then what happens, Andrew?
Then literally, you turn the page and you see the poor pig has been slaughtered, boiled in water, all its hair stripped off and its feet chopped off. And then the next picture is him sliced in half.
Mm.
Now, I think that wasn't. You see this in cookery shows around the world now, is that people are so desperate to kind of, you know, make this link between what the food on your plate and where it comes from, which I understand, you know, you shouldn't just believe that all kind of meat comes in a kind of little box of plastic over the top. But the fact is, you don't really want to look at this all the time, ever.
No. Sophie, you look perplexed.
I'm just interested that right next to that rather vivid sort of butchering story, there's a sort of soft-focused story about love and cohabitation, which is, you know, this amazing photo shoot, you know, couples in bed together and things. It's a rather interesting juxtaposition, really.
Mm. Well, but I think that also sort of speaks to, I think, you know, sometimes what you see in the German part of the newsstand as well is that, you know, never too far away, people might have their clothes off. And it does bring us back to, I think, one of our covers of the year, which, of course, was from the magazine, the Germans. Andrew, have you stumbled upon a quiz there? What is that?
I think this is how to play the recorder. So it's got all the kind of the where to put your fingers.
Right. Okay. And this is still a neon, so it is a bit of a how to.
Yeah, it gets quite practical at the back.
indeed, it does. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We are in Semrits. That's why it doesn't sound like we're quite in Studio One. This is our look ahead. We haven't done that yet. We are going to be taking a look ahead right after this.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Welcome back to this special edition of The Stack, coming to you from Semrits. Now, one of the best things about this little resort town is its two very well-stocked newsstands, bursting with titles in German, Italian, French, English, Russian, Spanish, and Portuguese. With an international client base jetting in and out throughout the winter and summer, we sent our Sophie Grove along to see what sells best.
Hello, I'm Yolanda Gossi. I'm Italian, and I work here for about 10 years. I come from Italy, near Chiavenna. Every day to work, and I enjoy myself.
Can you tell me a little bit about the newspapers you have here in kiosk? Which ones are the most popular?
The most popular, we got a lot of Italian newspaper, like Corriere della Sera, English, Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, a lot of German,
Frankfurter Allgemeine, Süddeutsche, Welt, French newspaper, Le Monde, Figaro, and also Arabian from Spain, and all the Switzerland newspaper.
Tell me about the local newspaper you have here, the one specific to the Engadine.
We got the Sograubünden and come every day. And Engadiner Post is the most popular. It's arrived 3 times a day, Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday. And we also have Bündner Tagblatt. It's more regional. Blick also is the most sold. Talk about all the news, also gossip. Otherwise, you got NZZ, is more political. It's from Zurich. And Tagi also, it's politics and economic.
Can you tell me how the international papers arrive here every day and they keep up to date?
They come from Muttenz, is the central, and then they come with a little bus. It stop in every kiosk and deliver all the newspaper. And they come here about 7 o'clock in the morning or even early. English come like Herald, Financial, and Wall Street came the right day. And Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail, and Times, they come one day later.
You've mentioned quite a lot of English papers, but I wondered how the selection and the popularity of the papers changes during the season, because, for instance, we're coming up to Russian New Year. Do you have to stock up on your Russian dailies?
Yes, because the real season starts after Christmas. We need more. And so we have to ask for more newspaper, like Russian, like English, Italian also, because the season starts after Christmas and until after Easter. And then it's finished, and then we need less.
And you also have a service where people can print the paper they want from all around the world. Is that popular, or do people prefer to have the paper of their choice in their hands printed from wherever its provenance is?
We got some family that lives here and arrived during the Christmas time, and they want the newspaper, the news from the real date. And also we got a lot from hotels. They've got some Arabian family or the Russian family, and they want also print on demand. They want the newspaper fresh.
And tell me about your magazines. Which of the magazines are the most popular, for instance, from the German language?
The most popular are Bunte and Gala, and also Fashion magazine, but the most popular are Bunte and Gala, from German, really from German.
And what are they covering?
They're gossip, more gossip magazine.
And can you tell me about any other services that you provide here at Kiosk that are perhaps unique to the brand Kiosk?
We can also send money, because we got Monogram from this year, and we sell money all over the world. And we also send packets. Instead of going to the post, we send people comes and we send it. Or with the one who comes with the bus, I mean. And we got a lot of books, souvenir, and and a lot of things for kids, like toys, chocolate also, yes. And something to drink, if you need something to drink, or DVD also, T-shirts, everything you need for your holiday, or if you want to take it something to remember your holiday. And
do you enjoy working with such an international crowd? Lots of customers from around the world.
Yes, because it's really interesting. Sometimes you heard a lot of story from other people, and it's really funny when it's crowded, so it's nice to work.
How many languages do you have to speak, or at least know a little bit of?
You have to know German, of course, and English also a little bit, French and Italian, because we have got a lot of Italian people, and that's all. I mean, Russian, it's a bit difficult at the moment. Yeah, or Japanese.
Thanks for that, Sophie. I mean, one of the things I also like about the bigger of the two newsstands here is how they've got that newspaper direct stand, and it's one of the only places where I really see it in full swing and use, and that, you know, people go in there, it's front and center, and because you do have such international audience, people are either getting their, you know, Norwegian daily, or someone's getting, you know, Svenska Dagbladet, and we've actually, you know, met those people several times, Andrew. Are you surprised that that hasn't taken off more? Because, you know, I quite like getting on, let's say, a Qantas flight, and they give you, you know, the digital print edition of the Sydney Morning Herald. I mean, as much as I want to have, yeah, of course, I want the original version if I could get it. But even still, if it's on the right paper stock, etc., there is just something about still that serendipity. Because, you know, some airlines are saying they're going to give everyone iPads now when they get on, then they can have their digital edition that way. I'm wondering sort of what your view is.
I think the one tricky thing about it is that actually, for many people, their appointment to purchase media is still a fleeting one. In their day, when they're planning their schedule, where they're going to shop, and they may put aside half an hour for the groceries. We know to our cost that when you go into a newsstand, if you don't see the thing you want, you walk out. And I think that's the problem, actually, is making people put time in their day to think, actually, I don't mind waiting 10 minutes while I'm in the news kiosk to print out two or three newspapers. That's fine by me. I think that's the only reason I think this has a slight drawback. But I think here it's just so perfect because there are so many different nationalities here in this one small town. Then suddenly it's really feasible because there's no way these newsstands could bring up all of the titles to cover all of the different demographics of them. Mm.
Sophie?
I mean, I love seeing front pages and seeing the editorial decisions that have gone into sort of what leads, what's, you know, on the sidebars, that kind of composition, and then you choose to sort of approach it that way. I much prefer to read the paper than look at it, you know, and then you make all these decisions yourself, and it's much more exhausting.
Yeah.
So I'd much prefer to just pop in there and have it printed out. We haven't needed to because we've just been nipping across the road to the nearer kiosk and just loading up with all the English language papers.
Now, Andrew, I've given you now the better part of 40 minutes to prepare your crystal ball and look across to, or looking across 2013 right now, and you know, where do you see things maybe from the daily point of view? I guess we probably all agree that we're going to certainly see more dailies go away. But as we said at the top of the show, you know, it could be quite interesting. You know, if Murdoch gets his hands on a Chicago paper, he suddenly, of course, you know, then has, you know, I mean, he already has the Wall Street Journal. You know, then you get your hands on something like the Los Angeles Times. I mean, you know, I don't want to say a renaissance, but could we see a really interesting rethink on paper, especially at the hands of people who are maybe more risk-takers like the Murdochs?
Well, I think what's interesting is if Murdoch gets hold of so many papers, he's also a believer in people paying for news. So if he would be introducing kind of paywalls across all of those papers and doing it in a creative way, I think that's going to be one of the biggest things of 2013. I think that in a lot of boardrooms, newspaper chiefs are going to have to be making some very quick, serious decisions about paywalls. And I think there's going to be quite a few newspapers who have been kind of determined, you know, that, you know, that they will always be free, that may be having to reverse those decisions. And I'd be interested to see, even in the UK market, where one or two papers have, you know, kind of, you know, bet the house against never charging, that you will see some kind of charging for some kinds of articles.
Do you think that's a newspaper that begins with a G?
I do. It just doesn't seem sustainable. Anybody who speaks to anybody who works there, they're continually trying to retrench on the number of staff they have. They have a real difficulty at the moment in the sense that they wanted people to leave and they haven't volunteered, but they have a guarantee that they'll never sack anyone under the covenant that they have with their staff. But I think that they will have to think how they're going to make money. And I think it's become almost a point of pride for them that they will not change their opinion. But when you see they're still losing almost £1 million a week, it just can't make sense.
Sophie?
I think it's interesting the effects of the paywall kicking in. You can sort of feel it, because actually something like the Times, you know, they were, you know, creating these sort of celebrity journalists, really. People were writing for not very much, and then their names were all over the internet. You know, they could have that huge audience, which they no longer have. Mm. So they're having to sort of recalibrate their approach and, you know, appeal to their niche market, the people who are paying for it. And that's had an effect in itself.
I mean, Andrew, do you get any sense of whether it's working for the Times? You know, they've more power to them for, of course, you know, sticking to their guns and erecting that wall and saying that there is a cost that comes with journalism, and you have to come along with us, and when you do so, then you're going to have to reach into your pocket.
I think it's working in a small but actually quite comfortable way for them. And that's why you've seen other newspapers like The Telegraph beginning to look at the same kind of, you know, the same possibilities. And I just don't think there's any other option in the end. And it was interesting today, kind of, you know, going to look at several sites to read stories. And, you know, actually, you go to the New York Times, they want you to pay. You go to the FT, they want you to pay. You go to the Times, they want you to pay. You go to The Economist, they want you to pay. And that didn't used to be the case even just a couple of years ago. You could have pulled up most of that information for free. And it really does feel like a tide is changing. And I think in a really good way, because I think also that it's become recognised by even people buying newspapers or reading online, that actually they always go to the same sources. You can't get this information for free. It costs money to make it, and why would you be giving it away for nothing?
Mm-hmm. Sophie, do you think there's going to be, maybe 2013 turns out to be sort of really the era of, well, one could almost sort of argue that maybe a generational shift, that the people who are just used to just getting everything for free, not just used to, just expecting it, they feel it's a God-given right that all information should be at their fingertips, and there should be, you know, they should not be funding it. Do we reach some type of tipping point?
I think you do, and it's really interesting to notice. You know, eventually, you realise that if you do have to pay for your, you know, the thing you want to read, you actually do dig into your pockets eventually and get it. And it's interesting that the news gatherers that aren't giving, that aren't actually putting their paywalls up, are sort of supporting a business model that just doesn't work, and it's sort of undermining the whole concept. Once they go, I think we'll see some real change. And as a journalist, I'm delighting in it, really, because, you know, you see people wanting, you know, this amazing high quality journalism, and they don't want to pay for it. You wonder if it's, you know, if they're sort of really, they understand the process. You know, it isn't a philanthropic citizen journalism model.
No, and I wonder if also other markets, you know, in a way, will also, you know, force this rethink, because I think, you know, as many as would agree, Andrew, you know, so many of the media companies have looked to the United States thinking just because of the scale of the market, the world's biggest economy, the power of U.S. media brands, well, they must have it right. And I think as we try to identify, you know, every day, every week, and also every month in the magazine, it's just not the case.
And I think the other thing to underline is, you know, the solution for the future is diversity, and that's different media brands finding what works for them. And of course, you will have some titles that are very successful as digital only brands, but they will be a small group, and the majority of people will still need to be doing something bigger. They'll still be need to do print, they'll still be need to have some other kind of way of pulling you into their fold. And I also think that you'll see quite a little bit of kind of tidying up around the edges, you know, that you'll see some media owners who just don't have the stomach for it anymore, and as you said, selling out. And it wouldn't surprise me if quite a few big papers actually changed hands this year, beyond the ones that you're talking about with the Murdochs.
Great. Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove, thanks very much for joining us on this very chilly day up here in Samaritz. That brings us to the end of this 19th edition of The Stack. Our producer up here in the mountains was David Michon. Our producer in London was Don Trump. And Jack Phillips was in charge of sound here in Samaritz, and Alex Funnell down the line in London. If you have any comments or suggestions for us, then please drop a note to info@monocle.com. I'll be on the road next week, but The Stack will be back in Studio One next Saturday at the same time with a very capable Monocle editor manning the mic. But for now, from all of us here in Samaritz, Happy New Year. Goodbye.